Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Is the end near? Is the Ukraine project about to be wrapped up? Trump's 28-point peace plan appears to force an outcome. Losing on the battlefield and growing political instability at home, the Zelensky regime may have no choice but to fold. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, Tarik Serhil Ahmad, in Istanbul. He's a historian and political commentator. And in Serbia, we cross to Aleksandar Pavic. He is a member of the Serbian Parliament. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's go to Aleksandar. You know, I'm kind of torn here. You know, should I focus my attention on the so-called 28-point peace plan, or should I focus my attention on the reaction to it? I'm kind of split here. Go ahead, Aleksandar.
Well, that's understandable because, you know, we're in a post-truth world where perception is much more important than fact. So, perceptions, reactions are more important than substance. Yeah, and that's what it comes down to. I'm torn as well. So, yeah, I look for the reactions to gauge where things are heading. As far as I can see, the biggest panic is in Kiev and in the European capitals. So we can see right then for whom the plan is, let's say, has the most negative connotations, because Kiev and Europe, the European leaders, this whole time, they're the ones who are the most afraid of peace. And this is alarmingly close to a chance at peace. And that's what's not giving them peace of mind. Because what are they going to do?
What are they going to do?
Yeah, they didn't bring Russia to its knees. You know, the sanctions from hell backfired. The sanctions from hell are actually hell for Europe, the EU. They don't know how to get out of this. And also, they've train themselves in wishful thinking so much, you know, they can't separate it from reality. This whole time, they've been living in this fantasy where somehow, some way, Ukraine is going to beat Russia. They just didn't know how it was going to happen, but it was going to happen. And all of a sudden, reality is sneaking up on them, and reality says, no, you've been wrong the entire time. You just didn't want to face it. Well, the key time, the time is coming where you have to kind of face the music. And what I'm concerned about is what the deep state always does at times like this: some sort of distraction, some sort of a false flag, just anything, just so that we don't have peace. You know, that's my biggest
or it also may signal this plan may signal other priorities. Okay, and I think it's a combination of things. I wouldn't use wishful thinking. I would say magical thinking on their
part. Yeah, it's even better.
Tarik, looking at the initial responses from the hysterical Europeans, that really just debased themselves. They just beclown themselves, and they were distracted by being at G20. This is not a Carthaginian peace. Actually, this is a pretty good deal for Ukraine.
Yes, I absolutely agree. Given the situation on the battlefield, this is still a pretty good deal. And it's, of course, worse than what Ukraine could have had in the spring of 2022, but the West, of course, prevented that from happening. And the Russians, to be fair, have always been explicit about this. The longer we fight, the worse the conditions will get for you, because we're winning. And this is what they're applying now. And frankly, it's fairly normal in the case of a war that the side which has the upper hand gets the advantages in a peace. But I also would like to underline what you've implied, Peter. This is not a capitulation. So if Europeans who scream about capitulation want to...
No, it's their capitulation. Gentlemen, this plan is more about the Europeans than it is about the Ukrainians, I swear. Go ahead, keep going, Tarik.
I would put it like that. It's more about the Europeans even than it is about the Zelensky regime. Let's not forget one simple thing. For the Ukrainians, in the sense of all of them, the ordinary Ukrainians, this plan is actually very good. Let's be clear about that. This slaughter for no conceivable purpose has to end, and it benefits them if it ends. And I assure you, there are a lot of ordinary Ukrainians who actually want this plan to happen. They just can't tell us about it because they're living under Zelensky. But here's the other thing. If they want to see, if the Europeans want to see what a real capitulation looks like, they can sabotage this peace again, and then the next one, and the next one, until Russia really is in a position to impose full capitulation. I think Moscow doesn't even want that. That's not its war aims, neither explicit nor implicit. But if we, the West, never allow Ukraine to finally make peace in this insane proxy war, then, you know, the logic of events might in a few years or even sooner lead to real capitulation. That's the real risk here. We would look back on this deal in 2 years the way we now look back on 22 as a great missed chance. To me, the big question is, I think you are both absolutely right, the Europeans are hysterical and insane, and they want to prevent this and sabotage this again. But the big question to me is, can they?
Well, that's the wild card in all of this. And we'll see that if Trump enforces the Thursday deadline. I doubt it. Okay. But I mean, Alexander, this, you know, the word capitulation is being, this is a capitulation on the part of the Europeans, not the Ukrainians. And so the capitulation that they want to avoid is the one that applies to them, not to Ukraine.
Absolutely. It's always been about not just the Europeans, but the Western deep state, because we have to remember a year ago, a little more than a year ago, Biden was still president. He may not have been aware of it, but he was still president. And we had a unified West. And it was the goal of the unified West to use Ukrainians as proxies in their war against Russia, and, you know, fight to the last Ukrainian. We no longer have a unified West. And Trump is not Biden. Trump is not the deep state. Yeah, Trump may be an old-fashioned imperialist, but he's not a globalist. And that's a big difference. And I think he genuinely wants peace. And, you know, that's the problem. The Europeans don't have Biden in the White House. They don't have Kamala Harris in the White House. They have Trump. And it's not a unified front anymore. And part of the West really does want peace, and that's the biggest problem for the Europeans right now. And what are they going to do without daddy? You know, what are they going to do without
What are they going to do, Tariq, without their rabid Russophobia? Because that is the organizing principle that von der Leyen and all the rest of them have, okay? And the justification to steal Russian frozen assets. With this plan front and center, it's impossible for them to continue that. And that's another thing that angers them to no end.
Absolutely.
Yes, the plan plainly contradicts the idea of stealing the Russian frozen assets. It has something to say about Russian frozen assets, but that would happen in cooperation with Russia, and it wouldn't be a steal to prolong the war. And it clearly excludes all these European schemes to steal. That's absolutely true. So look, to your first question, what are they going to do without their Russophobia? I think they don't know the answer, and neither do I, because the mistake they have made, and it was completely unnecessary, is to build so much of their own legitimacy on Russophobia. You can build legitimacy, which is normal for governments, on achieving security.
That was the whole mission of the European Union. Two pillars, security and prosperity. They have failed on both.
Exactly, but you can't build it on an illusory enemy. The Russians are not going to invade the European Union. They don't want to do this. But now, look at Germany. They have set in motion this insane policy of going into gargantuan debt, and all of it is supposed to basically flow into armament and armament-related infrastructure. They've bet the house, literally. They've bet what's left of the house on this. So it's no accident that in German you now have a new word, and you probably don't know this. The new word in German is Friedensangst, which means literally the fear of peace. What a perverse word. The fear of peace is stalking Germany now.
Wow.
Only the Germans could come up with something like that. But that's a topic of another program. Alexander, so and we have to be very clear, gentlemen, as we're convening right here, the Russian state has not had an official reaction to it. Okay, so let's keep that in mind. However, again, being focused on the Europeans, so if the Russians settle on the Donbass, parts of the other two oblasts, and Crimea, then they're not going to make a mad rush to the English Channel. Oh, that must be the fear of peace of the that the Europeans have. See, this is just how absurd all of this has been, Alexander.
Well, look, I can tell you a personal experience I had last week in the Serbian parliament. I'm a member of the Defense and Security Committee, and we had a visit from the chief of the Defense Committee of the German Bundestag, the German parliament. And, you know, he came to Serbia to talk about how Europe must prepare for war with Russia because Russia is going to invade NATO and Europe by 2029. You know, and all of us pretty much laughed in his face. But, you know, he wants Serbia to join the war effort against Russia. And, you know, you can see right then that there's peace is not an option for them. And, you know, they're using the Russian bugbear, they invented it in order to justify their own rearmament. You know, we're saying, you know, Europeans with any sort of historical memory know what it means when
Well,
Germany,
particularly Serbia has a historical
absolutely.
Memory.
Yeah, Serbs and Russians, you know, when we hear about German rearmament, all the red lights go off, you know, and you know, this guy comes in and he expects us to welcome this and say, oh, yeah, we're going to join your foolish, self-destructive war against Russia. Oh, yes, we are going to do that. Instead, you know, he kind of cut the meeting short because he didn't like what he was hearing. But we heard firsthand that what we're talking about this entire time, they really do want war with Russia. Of course, I think a report came out this morning. They can't even provide for Ukraine's defense, much less an attack against Russia. Of course, they would frame it as Russian aggression against them, but we know what's going on. You know, it's like when Hitler was attacking Poland, you know. Poland, you know, Polish, you know, German soldiers in Polish uniforms attacked German soldiers. And of course, you know, Poland was the one who committed aggression. You know, the same sort of mindset is in the EU right now, and it's really alarming. The only good thing is Big Brother across the ocean does not want to have any part of it as long as Trump is in the White House. And that's the good thing.
Yeah, well, and again, we have to, and maybe that'll be days and weeks from now, the motivations of for this now, because Trump is in big political trouble at home. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's peace plan. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Let me go back to Tariq here. Let's take a look at the 28 points. When I printed it out, I used my favorite fountain pen, and I just crossed off things that I thought were irrelevant, okay? A lot of it, the protections of minorities, freedom of religion, speech, political parties. Well, if Ukraine is going to be joining the European Union, which, you know, that's that appears to be at least on the agenda, all of those things are going to be taken care of. So they don't need to be part of a real peace agreement. What I focused on the most is security. And I think that is the Anchorage legacy here. Now, I'm not going to go into names who was involved in writing that because there's a lot of speculation. But somebody absorbed those points that the Russians made in Anchorage, because the most important things for me are security. They didn't use the term, at least in the translation that I saw, the indivisibility of security, but it's just about almost there. Your thoughts?
Yes, I would add one thing, Peter. As insane as it is, there are already objections to protections for the Russian language. right? Because, and this is still relevant, and I tell you why, because we know from the example of the Baltics that even being in the EU doesn't protect the Russian language. But that's just a side point. Back to your security issue. I totally agree with you. Clearly, somebody has taken Russia's demands into account. Let's not forget, Russia is making certain concessions, but they are minor by comparison, as is logical, because they're winning the war. What is interesting is that even this plan still foresees an army of 600,000 in Ukraine, which is actually a very large peacetime force.
Well, bigger than the French, the German, and the British combined.
And also, if you look at them demographically, that's a very large force. But fortunately, I think there are certain ideas about what type of weapons this force shouldn't have. For instance, long-range weapons that can reach Moscow and so on. There are ideas about where to put European fighter jets in Poland. There might be an implication in that and so on and so on. It is clear that if this plan were to be implemented more or less in this shape, major Russian security concerns would then have been addressed. Not all of them, not everything they formulated in December 2021. That was a bigger framework, right? Let's redesign the whole security order in Europe, which was a good idea. But that's not all inside this plan, I would say. But what's inside this plan are the specific aims they have formulated for Ukraine, which would help a lot. Closing NATO, closing NATO perspective, neutrality, and so on and so on. And it would be very helpful for the West, except, as we discussed, the West Europeans are no longer acting in their rational national interest. They're acting according to some other very strange logic, unfortunately.
You know, it's very interesting, Alexander, if you read it very closely, and it always catches my eye, and I'm sure it happens to you folks as well, when they say U.S., NATO, Ukraine. Well, obviously, the U.S. is part of NATO, so you always have to have a kind of, you know, let me read that again, because what does that really mean? But what's interesting is that kind of through the side door are these security guarantees, which, remember, gentlemen, it was like maybe 8 weeks ago, it was security guarantees. That's all they ever talked about. But it's not NATO driven. Again, this is like pouring a bucket of cold water on NATO, because they're not going to be the decision maker. As a matter of fact, they're going to be they're going to have to react to decisions made about them. It's another thing that Western commentary has hardly picked up on at all, because the NATO, Western Europe, is a supplicant, just like Ukraine. Alexander.
Yeah, well, they're not used to being talked about as an object of international relations.
They certainly deserved it. They earned it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think we have to say one thing. You know, this plan, it would actually be a big concession on the Russian part. They don't need this. Things are going very well for them at the front. You know, the Russians can take care of business. It's just going to take longer, lots more Ukrainian lives. But there's nothing that can stop Russia right now except a peace plan, you know. So I think the Russian leadership is probably gauging what they would gain by this sort of plan, which actually does not fulfill their initial war aims or the aims of the special military operation, you know, demilitarization, denazification. I think in 2022, that failed plan that Boris Johnson helped torpedo, it provided for, I think, a force of about 85,000 Ukrainian soldiers.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, and at the start, we have to remember, at the start of the special military operation, the Ukrainian army was at about 280,000 soldiers. Now, this plan provides for 600,000 soldiers and future EU membership for Ukraine. So, you know, if we go back to December of 2021, the two papers, the two proposals from Russia to the US and NATO, you know, among the proposal, part of the proposals was for all the NATO weapons that have been deployed in Eastern Europe to go back to positions of 1997.
Exactly.
So actually, Russia would be making quite a concession if they were to accept.
I think only on this program in the English language will you actually hear that. Okay,
absolutely.
I absolutely agree. But Tariq, because I mean, when I finished reading it, I said, and you've already said it, there's a recognition of Russia's legitimate security interests. For me, that's the win. Okay, and it's worth taking it from there. Alexander is absolutely right. I would posit 600,000 men. I don't know if they'll be able even to afford that.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
I think that will take care of itself. The denazification. Well,
it's actually there a little bit. I was going to.
Well, it is there because it's a problem that will internally take care of itself. I would say, but that's what I would posit. Keep going.
Look, I mean, I agree with Alexander in that if you compare to the initially formulated war aims, and especially the December 21 thing, Russia is making concessions, right? And this is another reason why this isn't a capitulation on the side of Ukraine. But I would also agree with you, Peter, in that ultimately this is an outcome, if it really happens, that constitutes a big win for Russia. Because the war is exerting economic pressure. Russia has held up much better than anybody expected in the West. Another piece of magical thinking. But we also know that it has costs for Russia. It also has geopolitical costs because it's binding their forces in this one spot. And there are other places in the world where they have an interest. So there are real goods here in this thing for Russia if it chooses to accept this. The other thing, I think, the European Union question. Look, if I were in Moscow and Ukraine would say to me, we want to go into the European Union, and the European Union, or at least the crazy ones who lead it, would say, yeah, we are ready for that, I would say yes. You two have fun with each other, because you're basically burdening the European Union with something it can certainly not manage. It can hardly manage itself, right? So it's complicated. That's all I'm trying.
Well, and Tariq, if you know anything about the economic lay of the land of Ukraine, most of the value that is generated for the economy prior to the SMO was Lugansk, Donetsk, Kherson, Zaporozhye, and Crimea. They will lose all of that. So good luck, Polish farmers. Good luck, Austrian dairy of workers. Good luck, because it's not going to be welcome. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you want to, you know, tie your knickers up into a knot, let them worry it about themselves. And I think that's the Russian attitude. You want it, you buy it, it's yours. Yeah?
Yeah. And look, one more thing, if I may, I don't want to take too much time. But there also is the fact that if this plan comes into action, the sanctions regime will change and at least diminish. And while Russia withstands the sanctions regime very well, we all know this, there is, of course, gain for Russia in the sanctions regime being reduced again.
True.
For example, some very basic, even humanitarian issues of getting Russian grain to market and thing, you know, kicking Russia out of the SWIFT system was a severe blow, but it was recoverable. Mm-hmm. But there have been certain issues where it has really been a real annoyance. And it's annoyance, I mean, something is grain. Okay. Oh, Alexander, I want to go back to, I mean, maybe I'm too focused on the Europeans and all this. And like I said, they've earned everything that's coming to them right now. This is a fundamental, unmitigated, unquestionable defeat for the current European leadership.
Well, absolutely it is. And, you know, the main thing, if the Russians were to accept this plan and something that resembles this plan, you know, the other thing is that would be a very big blow to the current European ruling elites, because, you know, you no longer have an excuse for this vast program of militarization.
And censorship and everything else that goes along with
it. Yeah, if you don't have a war in Europe anymore, if you can't manufacture this Russian supposed aggression that's supposed to come in 2029 because the war is no longer happening, then, you know, you're going to have to face your citizenry. You know, you're going to have to explain to them, why do we need to spend so much time on the military? We need to spend much more on, you know, the social system, on the economy, on getting cheap Russian gas again, because American LNG is way too expensive and unreliable, and there isn't enough of it. And, you know, accepting this sort of a peace, I think that's part of the Russian calculus. They may be losing something regarding their war aims, but what they're gaining is they're going to Europe is going to be destabilized within. Actually, not Europe, the ruling elites. Peace breaking out for them, it breaks their narrative, it breaks their political programs, and, you know, they have to face the music. And I think that'll be the biggest gain for all of Europe. I'm talking about the people of Europe, not the political elites. So that's the good part of this plan, even for the Russians as well.
Yeah, and also for our purposes, it'll be wonderful theater to watch. Tariq, prior to us convening here, I came across, I think it was in the FT, that the Europeans want to contribute, quote, constructive updates to the plan. That sounds very maniacal to me. 45 seconds. Go ahead.
Look, the big question with the Europeans is anybody going to listen who matters? That's the big question. The Europeans will try to sabotage this. If it's up to people like Kallas, Merz, and of course von der Leyen, they will, and Macron and Starmer, they will try to sabotage this. But the issue is, can they still do it? And I totally agree with Alex that their interest is in sabotaging it, because when this war ends, Europe will have, the European leaderships will have to face an enormous amount of very uncomfortable questions. And they might, as they are now, not politically survive those questions.
Yeah.
Well, I think all of us would like to know, with the $100 million energy defense sector scandal that was broken out, well, is that just the tip of the iceberg? Was that just the usual form of business? Inquiring minds would like to know where all that money went.
Good luck.
good luck. And I think also how much of it was kicked back. To the West. All right, gentlemen, that's all we have to say today. I want to thank my guests in Turkey, Serbia, and of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.